pornography with independent filmmakers, documentary, narrative. And I noticed that the work coming in from the pornography side, all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, but not so much on the independent side. And so I kind of got to realizing that there probably wasn't an awareness on the other side as to what some of the regulations were, and started educating myself. And it's a long process. I'm still learning, and delighted to bring all of these people in to help us with that. So I'm going to start with Violet, if you jump in.
Sure. Okay. My name is Violet Blue. I'm a blogger, podcaster, author, and I'm the sex columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. I've been a sex blogger since around 2001. I've been blogging on fleshbot.com, which is a pornographic blog, for the past couple of years. And I do a variety of different things, from all of the things that I just described to also speaking engagements, such as I just spoke at eTech about sexual identity online. I give Google Tech Talks on a regular basis every other month about sex and sexuality. The first talk I gave for them was sexual privacy online. Basically, the perspective I think that I'm bringing to this is observing the practices of primary and secondary producers of pornography, bringing in also a consumer angle, seeing what the consumer sees, and also the level of understanding what goes on with the performers and the participants as well. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I know a lot about porn.
My name is Joe Swanberg. I'm a filmmaker, and I also make a series for Nerve.com called Young American Bodies. I've never made any porn, but I have, the stuff is sexually explicit. So I think that's why I'm here. Is that right?
Yeah,
exactly. Hi, my name is Alan Levy. I am the token attorney on the panel. I've also, just as a disclosure, Lisa's also my spouse, I've always had an interest in freedom of speech issues, First Amendment protection issues. I've written articles about obscenity, the obscenity doctrine in terms of representations of and distributions of speech and content, whether it be for commercial purposes, film, art, text. As what I've noticed is that politically, it seems to go in cycles. Whether or not the government is prosecuting or going after certain kinds of content, or whether or not they're allowing certain levels of content. But I think it's important that we have panels like this to give people the ideas of and give people the knowledge of what and to be aware of, what statutes to be aware of, what's going on right now. And because the law is changing almost every day. And one of the things we're going to talk about here in this panel is, the obscenity, the record keeping requirements of a statute known as 2257, hopefully give most people an overview of what you need to know and what you need to do to protect yourselves.
Okay. Before we jump into that, I just kind of wanted to get some personal experiences from the panelists in terms of maybe any restrictions on sexual content you've run into, any war stories, what it's sort of like out there dealing with sexual content.
Restrictions in sexual content that I've run into. Well, mostly it's just been about observing what's been going on with the 2257 laws. And I'm sure we're going to get a good overview or explanation of what the 2257 laws are. And basically, they're federal record-keeping requirements that require primary producers to keep stringent records about the age and the identity of the people who are performing in their porn. So as someone who blogs about porn and writes about porn and also wants to direct consumers toward really good porn, it's been something that I've had to kind of keep an eye on and have networked with other writers and other bloggers about. So for instance, one of the best stories I heard was when, about a year and a half ago, when the 2257 laws, really came down and porn people were like freaking out because they didn't know, because the way the federal record keeping requirements are is that, and again, you'll get some more detail on this, but they're they're really onerous on people who make porn. So it's actually, it puts a lot of burden on the producer because it's not just about ensuring the age, but there's a whole lot of bullshit that they have to go through to keep these records and keep them in a place that's open to the public for a certain number of business hours per week. And so, you know, people who are, you know, wanting to do indie porn or even making independent films that may have, you know, that may even get an NC-17 rating or an X rating are going, what do I have to do to, like, you know, define basically obscenity under the law and then have to follow these laws. And then, you know, you have all of these people who really don't know that much about how to interpret the law, suddenly having to interpret the law because I took a photo of myself with, you know, my top off and I want to put it on my website. Does that mean I need to now have a place of business that's open 6 hours a week, you know, that has all of my documentation on file, like just all these, you know, it just, the interpretation has been really confusing. But I think the best story was talking with my friend Thomas Roche, who used to work at Eroscene. And Eroscene is, well, they're part of Eros Guide, which is basically a worldwide network that's sort of a sex guide for sex events and sex happenings and sex workers and all kinds of things. And they run a magazine. And with the magazine, they run a gallery. So they have images on their site. So when the 2257 requirements really came down and, you know, some porn sites were folding, some people went offline, some people just said, fuck it, and just went out of business. And just, they said, we can't maintain this in order to run our small business. Basically, he had to go through one of his assignments from his crazy boss was to go through each and every gallery and try to determine what was sexual conduct and what wasn't sexual conduct in each and every photo that they had on the site over the years. So basically, I was like on the phone with him for 2 hours and he's like, okay, so her ass is red. Is it red from a sunburn or a spanking? I think that was kind of like it in a nutshell. So that's one of my favorite, most humorous horror stories from my perspective.
It was a sunburn.
Exactly. In the shape of a hand. Happens all the time.
Well, I mean, thankfully I have faced very little restriction. Like with working with Nerve, they've been really open and I just produce that stuff and send it to them. And same with the filmmaking, since it's been stuff that I've funded myself, I haven't had to face restrictions in that way either. I've just made exactly what I've wanted to make. But, you know, the restrictions then come sort of after the fact through distributors and things like that who, you know, might not want to release risky stuff, and definitely through fears over the MPAA ratings and things like that. So making the work hasn't been hard, but, you know, finding outlets for people to see the work has been more difficult. But I suppose if these new laws go into effect, that making it will become harder too. So now I'm curious to hear what comes next.
Well, one thing I've realized is that the adult industry, the adult film industry, understands the laws. They have to deal with them every day. They're adapted to them. And for some people who have just heard the term 2257, actually 2257 was a statute that was passed nearly 20 years ago, right after the Mies Commission came out with its findings about the effects of pornography. The story of Tracy Lords became very popular, and Tracy Lords at the time was as big a name, almost the Jenna Jameson of porn at that time. Turns out of the 87 films she made, 86 of them were made when she was under 18. Hence, of those 87 films, 86 of them are child pornography, and they are illegal to have. They are illegal to show. And it caused quite a stir in the adult film world. It also caused quite a stir in general media. And so Congress instituted new statutes to require producers of adult film, of adult sexual conduct, to maintain records attesting to the age of all of their performers. And that's the basis of where the government came from in adopting these statutes. Now, the regulations have changed over time. And in addition, Congress also amended a new law called 2257A, which requires mandatory record keeping for simulated sexual explicit conduct. Ironically, the term simulated is never defined. in the statute. But that's a pretty much a shot across the bow against those in the Hollywood and independent film industry, because there's a lot of simulated sexual conduct that would not even be classified as porn. Also, I've noticed in more recent years with movies like Brown Bunny, movies like Short Bus, the HBO series Tell Me You Love Me, these are films and productions that have actual sexual conduct, which apply to the older existing 2257. These companies generally are aware of what record keeping they have to maintain, whereas the smaller independent film producer may not be as aware, but would still be required to maintain those records. And failure to maintain those records is a felony, which can lead to serious jail time and very serious fines. So that's why it's important to get this knowledge out there.
It's not just the independent film producer, too. It's the blogger that worries, too.
And exactly. Anything on the internet as well.
Well, just speaking from the Cinecrank perspective, when we do our film festival, it's Anthology Film Archives, Pioneer Theater, East Village. So if you're looking at community standards, that's probably about as liberal as you get. When I start taking it on the road, like looking at coming to Austin, I have to talk to local programmers as to what will fly in the community. Then it gets even more complicated if you start looking at distributing, and then particularly on the web, because the wrinkle with the web is that no longer do you have a physical boundary defining what your community is. Suddenly you have the real potential of being an artist working in the East Village, putting your stuff up online, and then maybe having some prosecutor in Western Pennsylvania, which happens to be one of the most conservative jurisdictions, prosecuting you, and you're suddenly having to go to Western Pennsylvania to defend yourself. So those are kind of the issues that come down. And one practical thing, we had a documentary a couple years ago that won a Best Short Award, Australian Documentarian. And when the new 2257 stuff came out, I sent it to him. You might want to be aware of this. He's like, well, I'm Australian. This doesn't affect me. But now he's trying to distribute his full-length piece in the States. He signed on a smaller distributor who himself wasn't aware of the 2257 requirements. And now they're having to go back and get those releases signed. It's much like if you have a basic release to shoot somebody, but it's so much harder after the fact of going back. And you know, this is like 5 years after the case. So just a practical consideration of how this can affect you. We're going to jump into some dry jargon here. We've got a slideshow here.
You all came for the dry jargon, right?
Came for the dry jargon. But my hope is to kind of get through this quickly. And then we're going to go back to the panelists and sort of talk about real world issues around that, and then come back to you all for questions.
Can I add an interesting note about the Tracy
Absolutely.
Lord story?
Yes.
No one ended up being prosecuted because she was using a government issued ID. She was using a government issued passport to make porn. So she had essentially spoofed the government and was using a government ID. So
nice.
The case was tossed.
So how do you get around that? Yeah.
Exactly. She was the first contract girl.
So
full of useless porn information. Come on.
Trivia. So an overview here. We're going to just touch really briefly on obscenity, which I kind of already did. Then the record keeping requirements for actual explicit sexual conduct. And then the same for simulated explicit sexual conduct. Obscenity. I don't know, Alan, do you want to take this one?
Just briefly, you know, the controlling case on obscenity is Miller v. California, which was a 1973 decision, which essentially defines obscenity as a three-part test. One, applying the relevant community standards. Is the material taken as a whole? Does it appeal to the purient interest? And purient interest essentially would be defined as what turns you on, what makes is appeals to the erotic nature in you. Two, does the sexual conduct, is it depicted in a patently offensive manner? And then three, what a lot of people understand as the SLAPS test, does it lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value? It's pretty much a well-settled decision and well-settled law. The problem is on the community standards for a lot of people. In 1973, if you had a piece of work, a film or a book, and you didn't want to distribute it to certain places in Utah, Pennsylvania, Florida, you didn't ship your book there. You didn't show your film there. But today on the internet, any community becomes the relevant community standard. You put a film or some kind of work on the internet that community standard deems to be obscene. The most restrictive community in the United States becomes the ceiling, or it becomes essentially the ceiling by which what is allowed. So the most restrictive community, that attorney general, U.S. attorney, can drag you into that community courthouse and prosecute you on obscenity, even though your server might be based in San Francisco or the East Village of New York. You could be prosecuted based on the standards of West Virginia or Utah or any other of the most restrictive communities. So that's what's created a lot of panic and a lot of concern for people, especially in the age of the internet.
And I think it was West Virginia. Every time I think, oh, it's so crazy out there, I'm just worrying about all this stuff for nothing. I think it was Abercrombie and Fitch in West Virginia where the store owner was actually arrested under charge of obscenity for some of the black and white shots. There was one where the jeans were kind of
showed butt crack.
Butt crack. So basically, and you know, a bit of a breast on one. So it's still out there. And I don't know. But to move on to, we still have more obscenity. Sorry.
Just people. A lot of people don't understand, don't realize that it's not just imagery or it's not video. It can be text. For example, there is a case going on right now. I believe the name of the website was Red Rose Stories, and a woman had stories about and really contemptible, horrific stories about child rape and murder and really sick stuff that might be contemptible to a lot of people. The government is prosecuting that woman under obscenity charges and there's no imagery, there's no photographs, no video. It's merely text that other people wrote. So it's important to realize that there is no exception to the obscenity standard, that it's not imagery, videos, or film. It could be any kind of work.
Then moving into the 2257 that we've been talking about. I don't know, Violet, do you want to?
Sorry?
Do you want to go through these bullets or do you? Oh, right.
It's your slide.
Okay. Okay.
Just got
here. 18 USC 2257 requires producers of actual sexually explicit conduct to maintain records, testing through the age. Then the attorney general is responsible for promulgating those. And this is my favorite part. They're kept on file by the producer, cross-referenced so they're easily retrievable by performer name and or title of the work and readily available for inspection by the attorney general or his or her designees. And basically what that requires is if you're a producer, you should be open and ready for business a certain number of hours per week, and the attorney general can just show up and look through your records.
No warrant, no warning. If your home is your place of business, your home is subject to warrantless, warningless searches from government law enforcement officials knocking on your door. Also, just understand that the regulations are the devil's in the details. It's the regulations that are what lays out the hours when the attorney general can show up, what kind of records to keep. And those regulations change over time. And people often might think, oh, well, that's the regulations that are applicable. Well, those actually changed 2 years ago, and they can knock on your door at almost any time.
What's interesting, though, is that the doors that they've knocked on have only been major producers of porn. There have been about 7 or 8 raids since the laws have come down, and they've only raided major producers like big AVN award-winning Wicked Pictures, Adam and Eve type, like Vivid and stuff like that. They haven't really gone after anybody small time, per se. I think the only people up on obscenity charges, well, the only conviction they got was Joe Francis from Girls Gone Wild.
And well, that's not obscenity. He's the only person ever to be convicted of 2257.
Right. And then the obscenity, the person who's up on obscenity is Max Hardcore right now. So,
yeah, I think it's kind of a risk awareness issue. We sat in on the fair use panel earlier and a lot of just discussion of assessing what your risk is. And, you know, judging from that, it's not a high level risk. Say, for instance, you're a kinky film festival and you don't want to publish your home address office on your website. You might still use like a UPS store for your address and publish that instead. Technically, that would be a violation, but we'll see.
I point out that I now will go to porn sites to look at their 2257 statements. And it's actually quite interesting, the range and the gambit of 2257 statements. My favorite one are, these records are available upon request. which is a direct violation of the regulations and the statute. You're supposed to give the government your address so they could go knock on your door. And there's a lot of people out there who don't know or don't think they have to provide that information.
What's been interesting in my experience is that occasionally on my personal blog, I'll blog about friends' porn projects that work for, you know, like major companies. And it's de rigueur for them to just send over the 2257 information to whoever the press is that is republishing the material just as a safety precaution, or they think that's what they should be doing. And at one point I reviewed one of Nina Hartley's recent films, and they said, oh, we'll just, you know, we'll send you discs and, you know, video and, you know, stills and all the stuff that you might want to need to promote it with, interviews, all of that stuff, and all the 2257 information you'll need. And I was like, okay. And then I just out of curiosity popped in the 2257 disc that they sent me. And on the disc was all the 2257 documentation that they were keeping, which meant that I had complete scans of the contracts that the performers had signed that included all of their real names, all names they had performed under, their home address, their telephone numbers, all of their personal information, their social security numbers, and then photographs of them holding up their photo ID, which was either a passport or a state-issued passport, and their social security card with, you know, all of their information on it. And I got this disc and I was like, I don't want this in my fucking house. You know, like, I don't want to be responsible for these people's personal information. And then that folded into one of the sexual privacy talk that I gave at Google later, because I was like, okay, these performers don't know that I have this information at all. You know, I now know Evan Stone's real name and where he lives. Does he even know me? Probably not. You know, and this is porn companies doing what they think they should be doing to follow the law, and the documentation is very stringent, but it's also putting people at risk in terms of privacy. And I think that, you know, folding into what you're talking about with how onerous all of the requirements are on everybody, I think that it's part of the government sort of mafia strong arm tactics to make it more difficult for people to, and more threatening for people to be in porn and make porn. But that's just my opinion.
And just as a matter of course, they're probably sending that info to anyone who's reviewing
anyone.
The piece.
Yeah. Anyone, yeah. So, you know, it's sort of like, in a way, you know, for someone who is currently stalked and has been stalked in the past, I'm like, wow, this is a stalker's payload. And I remember also, you know, I can't remember the performer's name exactly, but when, you know, the 2257 stuff first came down, one female porn performer actually had people showing up at her house, fans showing up at her house. So remember her name. We blogged about it.
Jumping back to definitions, the statutes that came down in 95, primary producer, anyone who creates a visual representation of actual sexually explicit conduct, coming up with that again. But then 2006, they expanded the definition. And this is what will concern a lot of people in the room, if you're a web person, blog, if you're working with any of these images, suddenly we have a secondary producer. And that's anyone who uses these images for assembling, manufacturing, publishing, duplicating, reproducing, reissuing any of that material. And then anyone who uploads these images to a website or otherwise manages the content of the website. There's some outs if you're not actually changing the content, but you still need to certify that documentation exists. And the compliance
And just form. So you know, for the secondary producers, in most cases, will not have access or even know who the primary producers are or who the performers are. And they still have to maintain, in many of those aspects, the same record keeping as the primary producers or the ones who have filmed or recorded the actual performers.
And then this is what the compliance forms keeping track of, like Violet was talking about. Date of birth, all names used, legal name, and then the ID numbers, which quite often has access to the addresses. And this is my favorite slide. So regulated depictions already covered sexual intercourse, and just so we don't have any quibbles, genital, oral, anal, and persons of the same sex or opposite sex. And then we'll also toss in bestiality, masturbation, and then sadistic or masochistic abuse. I've always thought that should be an and/or. And then the new restrictions add the lascivious exhibition of the genitals or pubic area of any person. So that, so that's going to affect a lot more people right there. And then this is where we bring Joe into the picture.
Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Joe. Congress expands it to simulated conduct. And that's basically coming out of the Adam Walsh Child Protection Safety Act and protecting the children again. And in this case, simulated is never defined. So, you know, think of all the movies you've seen in the past couple of months that have some kind of sexual conduct going on in it.
I think it's also important to remember the 2257A is not in effect yet. It goes into effect 90 days after the Attorney General promulgates his regulations about how to comply with 2257A. Although the last time 2257 regulations came out, there was an interesting comment that then Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said. Section 2257A requires that producers of visual depictions of simulated sexually explicit conduct maintain records documenting that performers in those depictions not be minors. This raises a few interesting questions, considering they don't define simulated sexual activity. Is Taxi Driver, where Jodie Foster, 12 years old, portraying a 13-year-old prostitute, unlawful? Is Hound Dog, a movie that premiered at Sundance last year, where a 12-year-old Dakota Fanning is raped, is that unlawful? There was two movies that were nominated for Best Picture this past year, Juno and Atonement, where there was simulated sexual activity involving characters under 18. In Juno, Ellen Page was 20 years old at the time. In Atonement, forgot the actress's name, was actually Juno Temple, ironically, was 17 years old at the time that she was filmed during that scene. Now raises that question, is Atonement unlawful? According to what the Attorney General writes, that could be if you are having minors representing roles that are doing simulated activity. And like Lisa was saying, almost any movie out there, depiction out there, any kind of lovemaking scene would necessarily have simulated conduct or fit that definition. I saw a short that Joe made, was it last night? Or last night.
Swedish Blue Balls.
Swedish Blue Balls. I highly recommend it. The movie, not having Swedish Blue Balls. Not what the character had to go through. You can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, well, I shot that in Sweden, so does that apply?
If you're going to produce it or distribute it in America.
I see.
Were those girls of age?
Yeah. No, they were. I have no question about that. I mean,
the Fifth Amendment rights.
Okay. Yeah. I've never sort of had anything that flirts with that danger zone. Everybody that I've worked with has been in their 20s, and that hasn't been an issue. But it's definitely. I work from home, and would I suppose have to put my address up, is that right? And keep my house open during certain hours for Alberto Gonzalez to come over.
I think it'd be somebody else now.
Yeah. So that would clearly affect me quite a bit to change the way that I work, basically. I mean, so what are the options then? You said you can't create like a PO box or something else, or I mean,
that's my understanding.
Are there record? Are there I suppose I should go into the business of like opening up spaces where people can keep records.
I believe for that there stuff. Are probably agents that will do that.
Right.
Violet, do you know? I know there are businesses around the record keeping part.
There are businesses around the record keeping part. And a lot of times distributors, the way that the porn is distributed, mainstream porn is distributed is sort of like, It's like a tree and a tree and a tree and a tree that has just like a couple of central people up at the top, and then a variety of other distributors that branch down. Mm-hmm. And distributors that will be parents of other distributors will have a web page with the list. you know, that says, you know, these productions, and then where the records are kept. So it's very confusing and very complicated.
Also want to point out, while this will generate fear in many of the film independent and Hollywood industry and the smaller producers, also it's important to understand that the government generally goes after low-hanging fruit. In the cases of obscenity prosecutions, I believe the current biggest one going on right now involves a producer, Rob Black. I believe the company's Extreme Associates, and they were actually depicted on Frontline about 4 or 5 years ago. And he makes these films, simulated rape, simulated snuff movies. It was so extreme that the Frontline camera crew actually walked out of one of their filming because it was just too intense for them to watch.
Or so they said. It was pretty over-dramatized because it was Frontline.
I certainly will give them, they probably took some poetic license, but I do remember the producer, Rob Black, telling the government, saying, you know, yeah, I make obscene work. I dare the government to come after me. Well, generally, when you take that kind of position, the government will oblige you. And you know, certainly, if you look at it from a marketing point of view, hey, you're getting your name out there. But certainly, even if you face prosecution, even if you win, if you ask you know, any of the people who faced prosecutions in the 60s and 70s that helped define our obscenity laws and helped define civil liberties, that costs a lot of money. And some of them go to jail. And, you know, even if you win at trial, you've spent thousands upon thousands of dollars. So it's important to, you know, just be aware of what the considerations are when you're making films. And you can know where the line is. I mean, there will be people who try to cross that line and nothing happens to them. And there will be those that do everything right and sometimes get into trouble as well. But it's simply a aspect of calculating your risks and trying to do what will not necessarily get the government looking at you. So there are certainly safer ways of doing things, safer ways of depicting conduct and content. But that being said, the people in the room are artists, and they want to sometimes push those envelopes. And there are ways of doing it and ways of you know, being smart about it.
Pilot, you were saying earlier that you had a lot of friends who were sort of in various states of dealing with the regulations.
That's correct. I actually had a question for you, and you said...
Oh, boy. Well, the answer is I dared the government to come after me last week. And okay. So far, nothing has happened.
I'm glad you have a prepared answer.
Yeah.
That's excellent. No, but so you do work for Nerve. Is that correct?
Nerve. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a, I'm an independent something, you know, like I'm not an employee of Nerve, but
right.
yeah, that's right.
Do you do any like sexually explicit stuff for them or kind of?
No,
just
this show. But I mean, the show's sexually explicit. Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything that they are having you do or any records they're having you keep or do they?
No.
Are they handling it themselves or?
I don't know.
Okay. Cause I know that Nerve spoke or Nerve went and testified against the recent round of 2257 regulations, right?
I don't know.
Yeah. I think the guy that runs Nerve.
Rufus,
was one of the people that went and spoke on behalf of free speech. So, and I think he actually blogged about it when he did it too. So
yeah. I mean, as far as that goes, you know, this stuff is the stuff that I'm making for Nerve. I'm still the copyright owner. So I would assume that Nerve is not handling any record keeping. That probably falls on me.
Perhaps. I mean, it's a matter of...
But they're distributing it, so...
Yeah, that's true. So they could, I mean, since they're hiring you, they could be seen as a primary producer.
Right.
Although I'm sure we're not talking about penetration. You know what
we're
I mean?
We're not. No, it's all, I mean, it's all would fall under what would be categorized as simulated, but...
Right.
That still seems like it's a little up for grabs.
Well, see, and then it turns into this, like, whole huge gray area... Beginning with that and then also ending with what are community standards on the internet?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, also, I mean, that idea of simulated or actual seems weird because a lot of times, how could you tell unless you would just have to take someone's word for it, I guess.
Do you have lascivious exhibition of the genitals?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I'm a fan.
Well, there also is news that is good. Recently, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned 2257 on constitutional grounds. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals generally is a pretty conservative circuit. It's comprised of Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Michigan, and they actually overturned that the entire statute. And ironically, it was based on the protected speech of swingers. It wasn't film people. It wasn't civil libertarians. It was a group of swingers who were publishing a magazine. And the government said, well, in light of Lawrence v. Texas, which was a recent Supreme Court decision that held that sexual conduct between consenting adults was protected activity, and the rights of adults to engage in anonymous speech, this statute impinges on and chills both sexual conduct and anonymous speech. And as a result, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals said that's unconstitutional and struck down the statute. Currently, the government is seeking to appeal, and it may go to the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve. But what we've noticed is that in cases of 2257 regulations or the statute, whenever it's been struck down, Congress tends to rewrite the statute in a way to fix it. The last time it was rewritten, a different party happened to be occupying Congress or a majority of Congress. So you might have a different political bent now. But it's always important to maintain that this area of law is constantly changing. And eventually, you do have successful cases that are happening. And just a bit of just for shameless self-promotion, I also have a little handout I've drafted up just to give a brief overview of 2257A, which certainly can pick up. Also, another shameless bit of promotion, an article about 2257A coming out in next month's Yale Law Journal. So I certainly invite people to take a look at that.
Next time you're reading the Yale Law Journal.
It's actually on their online portion, so they're adapting to the times as well.
I think we can jump to questions. If you're in the Sixth Circuit,
if you're in Kentucky and Tennessee, generally when one court overturns a statute on constitutional grounds, technically only in that court, if it happens to be in a district court, which is a trial court, that state or that district, it might be the law of the land. In a circuit court, it's in those states. Generally, what happens is the government does not like it when one of their laws is deemed unconstitutional in one part of the country. And they will do everything in their power to get that decision either overturned by a higher court or try to rewrite the statute. But I've generally noticed that when one portion of the country finds it unconstitutional, the government has a very tough time prosecuting people in other parts of the country. But technically, even in Texas or in California or New York, that is still the law of the land.
And in this case, what they've chosen to do is rewrite the statute. And there was actually a small window period where people online could send or email or even actually snail mail in their opinions about it. And I blogged about it when that.
Actually, the decision to overturn the statute came after the public commentary period.
Okay. So. Well, I had the public commentary on my blog. So. Mm-hmm.
Technically, the U.S. attorney, you might remember with the news where a few U.S. attorneys were fired by the president. The U.S. attorney of each of those districts is in charge of basically the chief law enforcement officer in that particular district. What they'll do is they might use a postal inspector to ask for somebody to mail something to that postal inspector. And once the mail is received, They could then say, ah, I received the mail in my district of Pennsylvania. I can now prosecute you, even though you're based in Texas. I can now prosecute you in Pennsylvania. So the government does have ways in order to go after you wherever you are in the country. And on the internet, it's made a lot easier.
So for like $16, maybe if you want nicer content for your girls or whatever, or boys or whatever you're buying, it's more. But still, for a fairly small amount of money, you can buy 22.7.
And it's all there.
Yes.
Yeah, it is cheaper than digging through the trash. That's correct.
Okay, there you go. It's all right.
Cheaper than digging through my trash, yeah.
I'm not totally, I know a lot of people have gone to, can you? Okay, great.
Well, actually, I forget what law he was, what way he was going to government, but there was a Spanish man with servers in Spain selling some service that the U.S. government didn't like, but his registrar was in the U.S., so they could donate.
That just happened.
So if you have anything on U.S. Under jurisdiction of the U.S. government, they'll go after you.
Just remember, you can set up shell companies outside of America. But once they find you and they know where you are, you know, whether or not you're even setting up, I believe on 60 Minutes, they showed the guys who set up the gambling websites and they base in the Cayman Islands. Problem is, making a lot of money, they can't come back to America because if they do, they're going to get arrested and face prosecution. So yes, you could try to set up these outside shells to try to protect yourself, but if you're going to engage in that kind of activity with the U.S. government and their resources they have, I think you're going to figure out who's probably going to win in the long run. But you take that risk if you try to set that up. Well, I've seen a lot of these 2257 statements now. The records are kept in Brazil where it was performed and or outside countries. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I think, again, it's another one of these examples where for the porn companies, they're trying to create another shell to make prosecution a little more difficult. But in the end, the government usually has a way of finding the money. And they could say, you could say, hey, we produced this in Brazil. It was a Brazil producer. But then they say, but you're the American porn company who's making the money selling this stuff. We're going to consider you a producer. Where are your records? You don't have them. You could be deemed in violation of the law.
Typically, the distributors, though, like if you go to like EEBN or something like that, they're going to have a list of the titles with where they claim that the documentation is kept. Even if it's an import title, like from private, which would be European or something from Brazil. So, because in order to get, like, the porn distribution in the United States is really locked down in so many ways when it comes to mainstream porn and accessing the mainstream porn market. So there's really a limited number of channels that companies can go through that, or they can be acquired by, or they can be under the umbrella of. So they usually end up on the same sites in the same major lists. So
So I know like MySpace and Facebook prohibit adult content, probably partly because of this, but if someone were to be running like a social networking site where people were uploading sexually explicit photos, how does this affect that? Like who has to maintain the record?
Well, that's that when they were doing the public commentary, we're talking about, there was some activism going on in the porn adult industry community, but where it suddenly picked up a lot of steam was the Gay Lesbian Task Force picked it up in terms of social networking sites. So I know part of the interpretation is, yeah, it does affect them and affects swing sites. And But the other thing I wonder about is with all the youth porn and porn tube, what happens in the face of all that?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that a good number of those sites are owned by larger distributors anyway.
Right.
So, and they'll link back their 2257 pages to the larger distributors that they're getting their content from.
So those aren't really amateurs?
It's called Pro-Am. They're professional amateurs. But it's interesting. I've been doing some consulting. So I live in San Francisco. So, you know, people who want to do like, you know, suicide girls wannabe startups and stuff like that, they'll send me an email and I'll consult with them a little bit just about, you know, just sort of best practices and privacy and stuff like that. And, you know, some of them are just so freaked out. Like there's one site that is, you know, they're gearing up to launch pretty soon and they've got, you know, local photographers and, you know, the photos of the girls are just, the girls aren't even touching themselves. That's how freaked out this social networking site is. But they're making everybody keep 2257 documentation like stringently because they're so worried and their lawyers are cautioning them to the extreme when, you know, at the same time, it's like I said, you know, only the majors have really been, you know, gone after at this point. And, you know, the Gonzalez seven or eight, however many you want to count them, attorneys across the United States were fired allegedly for not pursuing porn as much as the current administration wanted them to. So I think that I just brought up a whole lot of issues with one answer.
Well, there is one of the concerns that the courts have raised is if you have a movie, whether it be after 1995 when 2257 applied or when the new regulations applied, and it does not have the record keeping compliance statement on it, one could argue that that is a constitutionally protected piece of work that can't be shown or distributed simply because it lacks the actual statement on it. And the courts have been concerned by that because the whole basis of these statutes to ensure that the performers are not minors. And there's no exception to the statute, meaning you could have 60-year-old performers. They have to maintain those records, even though it's clear that they're not minors. There's no exception in the case of whether or not the records might have been lost. I mean, it certainly, there are concerns about whether or not that material would still be constitutionally protected under other speech, under other requirements. But because this statute, you would face prosecution by distributing it, it now creates what's called a chilling effect. In the case, the Sixth Circuit decision, they used an interesting example. They used, even in the way the statute's written, even if a married couple engages in sexual activity and videotapes themselves. They don't want to distribute it. They don't want to sell it, not do anything with it, just keep it in their house. They have to maintain records of their own ages and their social security numbers and maintain those records and allow the government to come into their home at any time to inspect those records or they are committing a felony. And the circuit court appreciated the absolute ridiculousness of this statute as it's written. And basically said, well, that would just chill speech. It would create a chilling effect. And so in that case, at least you have some courts that are saying this is going a little too far.
They're bullshit. It's the leaked celebrity sex tape. Is bullshit. They've got the documentation on file by the time it's being distributed. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's ridiculous. There's no such thing as a leaked tape. You know, if it's out there, that means that someone's got the records on file. If it's for sale, if you can find it, if you can see, find it on the internet, you know, if it's on someone's site, the permission is already out there. So it's hilarious.
What are those? Like, I mean, is there a certain way those records have to be kept? Like, or if like somebody who is a celebrity who you can have access to all their information, Can you just put it together yourself, or is there a certain?
We need to fix a copy of their ID, but that would be
right. Like,
well, the address of where the records are has to be on the work, either on the video box,
right?
Or
at right. But I'm saying is, yeah.
What like, you're asking is, can you get it like after the fact,
yeah,
or without them knowing?
Yeah,
or,
if you know somebody's age, you know whatever, like
right.
you can find their social security. Could you put together all the required documents without their consent?
From the documentation that I've, the actual physical documentation that I've seen, the way that people have been keeping it, it's contracts that the performers fill out with their signatures on them.
Right.
So, and then them hold with their pictures, yeah. you know, attesting to the fact that it's actually them.
Right.
So. So I would say that it probably would be a really flimsy way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there any guidance in the regulation of what happens? So you produce your work, you put the address where to find the records. What happens if your business moves? Like, is there guidance on that? I mean, I'm curious. Like, could I open a business, shoot the thing, produce it, put the records, hold records there, move?
That might be into one of the areas where retaining good counsel and would help provide you that kind of information.
That's not a legal opinion.
Well, right. No, I'm just saying, look, any kind of legal opinion you get for free, you get what you pay for. But certainly this is one of the areas where good legal counsel will give you some...
There isn't any kind of real guidance in regulations about that.
In many of the regulations, it could be left up to interpretation.
Whether it was good faith or...
I think that might be one of the topics where good legal counsel.
It's an interesting idea, though. So what she's asking is basically, is there a way that social networking sites can craft into their terms of service something that would protect them? Does that sound like an accurate?
I think it's a great question. And you got to understand that many of these laws and regulations are less than 2 years old. And it's what you might call a law professor might call an unsettled question or a gray area. In other words, I don't know. And a lot of these times, eventually what happens in any type of law where a new law gets instituted, you eventually get a general practice among lawyers and the people in the business. And either somebody's going to get hit or somebody's going to get through. And if somebody gets hit and somebody gets prosecuted and there's a problem, then everybody scrambles to try to come up with new ways of resolving it. And I think eventually in the terms of record keeping for Hollywood and independent film, they're going to be looking at the adult film industry about how they've been doing it for 20 years. And they will learn on those types of lessons. But eventually there's generally no right answer.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, maybe two questions. You want? Okay, yeah.
Been waiting patiently.
You mentioned
I can't remember who owns XTube off the top of my head.
Yeah.
They're pretty much all owned by someone. It was pretty interesting for me to find out, actually.
Okay, and our last question. Well, I know there was some discussion about taking out some of protecting the actress identity more, but I don't know what other changes would come down because that did seem to be a valid concern and they were addressing that, but. I think, and wasn't that part of the decision itself, was that it would be too complicated to try to fix it and redress it?
Well, the court could have tried to do what's called a limiting construction, strike out a few words out of the statute to keep it constitutional. But a majority of that court said that it couldn't be rewritten. And I could get into a more complex area, whether it's commercially distributed or not, because in terms they're protecting child pornography. Most child pornography is not commercially distributed. It's traded. And therefore, to try to rewrite the statute, the court said it would just be a jumbled mess. And we can't do that. Congress, if you want to rewrite the statute, be our guest. So, and certainly you can read more about that in my in this, and also my article in the Yale Law Journal. So,
well, on, oh, sorry. Yeah. On those websites where anybody can upload a file, I mean, it's just a file. So if
oh, it's awesome. I mean, each one has their own form for uploaders to fill out.
Okay.
And they're like,
and that covers them for the.
Who the fuck knows? Like, it's each one, because
what do the forms ask for?
It's the Wild West.
The forms ask for a variety of different things, and I went through the upload process, not because I have anything exciting to upload, but just because I was researching, like, when a lot of these sites first came out, I wrote a big article about them for the Chronicle, and I was like, you know, wondering how they were following, or, you know, were they secondary producers, like what the deal is. And so I went through filling out all their forms, and each one was different. Each one said, you know, it would be like, click this box if you have the records, or here's where you can upload the records, you know, or, you know, type in the address of where the records are, or, you know, it's just they're all over the place. Like,
it's
each
like
one
the
of them.
Kiosk when you go to the airport after 9/11, did you pack your own luggage? Yes. Are you shipping any firearms or explosives? No.
It's like, are you 18 or over? Yes. Yeah.
I mean, from what I've seen on these X-Tubes, porn, U-Porn, it's like the Wild West. I think a proactive attorney general, government official, could probably have a field day going after these people, whoever they are, and trying to track down. But like I say, eventually a generalized practice will develop, but right now, those kinds of sites, it's lawless. It is like the Wild West.
Can I add a comment too? The 2257 law applies to what date onward? 1995,
sort of.
Well, the regulations 22. I believe there's a date in July 3rd, 1995.
Yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
And then the new regulations were supposed to be applicable after 2006,
right?
But then the Sixth Circuit struck down the statute, so a lot of it still needs to be sorted out.
Right. So keep in mind that anything that was made before that date doesn't fall under 2257 regulations. So there doesn't need to be any record keeping requirements about age or anything like that, because it's all for the kids. It's all to protect the children.
Absolutely.
And that came up when there's a company here in Texas actually. That is a distributor, and what they do is they take old clips and they just throw old clips together, like, you know, because basically there's a small amount of money to be made in the resale of older clips, and then piecing them together, repackaging them, putting a nice shiny new picture on the box cover, which is just one of my hugest pet peeves about porn, is false box covers, and then reselling them. And then one company down here in Texas took a picture of a girl, Laura Jade. And the picture that they took, so they snagged it from, I can't remember, like her LiveJournal page or something like that. And at the time in the photograph, she was 14. They slapped it on the box cover, put it up for sale, and she, found out about it. And it was interesting. The platform that she used to get the message out to ask for help was Flickr. So she did a Flickr post saying, this box cover with me on it. I was 14. My mom took this photo. Like, I'm not in this porn film. And I wrote a big article about it. I called the guys down here in Texas who distributed the film, who put the pieces together and sent it out to the distributors. And I was just sort of like, you know, and it was like clips from the 80s or something like that. You know, it wasn't even what was on the box cover. And I was like, so where'd you get the picture? And they're like, I don't know, it's on Joe Bob's computer, you know, and that sort of thing. And I was like, well, where, you know, do you have any, you know, what would you say if anyone asked about your record keeping requirements? And they're like, oh, it's before that time, so it doesn't matter. I was just sort of like, wow, that's pretty deep. That's, yeah. I'm glad that we're protecting the kids that way.
So in closing, I wanted to note, Violet, you're doing your talk tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. I'm running a panel tomorrow called Sexual Privacy Online. And that's going to be a very interesting panel. I have the head of UC Berkeley's cyber law division from Bolt Hall, who is also a former EFF cyber lawyer, who's going to be on that panel. I have Abby Lee, a.k.a. Zoe Margolis, who was Girl with a One-Track Mind, who is an anonymous blogger who was outed by the UK paparazzi tabloids to talk about her experience of anonymity and being exposed. I have Jono on the panel. He's my editor at fleshbot.com, and he's going to talk about what we do there. And I also have a hacker to talk about different ways that privacy can be exploited online, specifically in a sexual context. So that's tomorrow, same time as this, 5:00.
Great. And then Joe, you're premiere?
Yeah, my new feature, Nights and Weekends, has its world premiere tomorrow night at 9:45 here in the convention center. And then that short film I did, Swedish Blue Balls, is part of the Midnight Shorts section.
Cool.
Go see it.
Hopefully.
Which one? The feature is tomorrow night at 9:45, and I think the next Midnight Shorts screening is Tuesday.
Is there sex in the feature?
Yes. Awesome. You can all see me naked.
So on that note, thank you all for coming out.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you. So we have handouts here if you want them.